You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
My name is Bruce Katz. I'm a vice president at the Brookings Institution and director of the Metropolitan Policy Program with Amy Liu. I want to invite everyone here for what I think is going to be an incredibly informative day, focusing on the arts, new growth theory, and economic development. And right off the bat, I just want to say, you know, to Rocco and Michael and Sunil, congratulations for getting here. I mean, you know, what you've embarked upon, I think, is absolutely necessary, which is to provide a sort of rigorous, disciplined platform for the conversation of the role that arts and culture play in cities and metropolitan areas. What you're trying to do today is not easy to do, okay? I mean, you're trying to connect academic to practice, theory to policy. We try to do this a lot at the Brookings Institution. Sometimes we succeed, sometimes we fail. But, you know, it all comes down to what Senator Moynihan said, you know, everyone is entitled to his own opinion, but not his own facts, right? Maybe even not his own theory. So I think you're making a great intellectual contribution and commitment here. And I think the reason that this is so important is that, you know, we're living in a period. I mean, frankly, we're living in a century that's an urban age and a metropolitan century. So I would say for the past 30 or 50 years, with the exception of people like Ann Markison and others, you know, a good portion of the academic discipline did not focus on the whole, the collective, the city, the metropolis. They sort of dove down into segmented and compartmentalized areas of discipline. The U.S. is a very specialized kind of place. And at the end of the day, how cities function, how metropolitan areas function, the clustering effect, the concentration effect, the agglomeration effect, talent and firms and creativity, that's what drives national economies. That's what's the vehicle for environmental sustainability. Those are the agents for social inclusion, right? So cities and metropolitan areas here and abroad is the topic, is the unifying thread of this century. And arts and culture are just fundamental to quality of life, but even more important, to attraction and retention of talent, and providing a platform for long-term growth. So I just want to, and you know, before I introduce Rocco, just give you one anecdote about how important this is. As some people in the audience know, my newfound obsession, though it's been an obsession for about 5 years right now, that's a long obsession, is about whether the 21st century will evolve as a network of trading cities. I mean, whether we'll go back to a period of time, you know, pre-nation state, where cities really trade with each other and form these very special and distinctive relationships. And I was at a dinner about a month ago with the ambassador from Mexico, expecting to have a conversation about auto supply chains, right? Really exciting stuff. And he opened up the conversation and then continued the conversation, first with a discussion about the new growth theory, frankly, and the role of talent and the role of concentration agglomeration, and then proceeded to have a conversation of how critical cultural exchange between cities, between metropolitan areas, between states, between nations, is to ultimate trade, commercial exchange, and economic performance. That in many cases, cultural exchange starts as a platform. Now, this could be the second conference, right, you know, so that we can explore all this. But I just found it remarkable, and frankly, it's been repeated in conversations, you know, with other embassies and individuals, particularly from cities in rising nations. Not the mature economies, but the rising nations, talking about the role of arts and culture as helping to establish relationships between and among cities and setting a platform for broader trade and exchange. So we're on to something here. This is the inquiry or the area of inquiry, I think, that so many different disciplines need to come to. What makes cities work? How do cities function? And thinking across disciplines. With that, I'd like to introduce the master of ceremonies, I suppose, today, Rocco Landsman, chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. He's been the chairman of the NEA since August 2009. So congratulations for making it through this far. You know, you know, I mean, in a prior life, you know, Broadway, producer, all, but this is the national stage. And the politics of Washington is something that it's hard to imagine anyone can really understand until they experience it. So, Rocco, phenomenal tenure, and thank you for this.
Thanks, Bruce. Thanks both for welcoming us this morning and for being such an extraordinary partner in planning today's convening. Bruce is one of the very first people I met with when I came into the NEA, and I came away from the meeting thinking, my God, this guy's smart. There must be something we can do with him, must be some way to interact with Bruce and Brookings. And finally, after a couple of years, here we are. I've been asked a lot recently about what I think we've been able to accomplish in my time at the NEA, the key phrase being what I think we've been able to accomplish. And today's event embodies the three most important themes, in my opinion. We've worked to make new partnerships for the agency. We have elevated the work of our Office of Research and Analysis. And we've worked to underscore the relationship between the arts and, for lack of a better phrase, the real world. As I said, I met with Bruce early on, and we began talking about what we might be able to do together. And when Michael Rushton, who co-edits the Journal of Cultural Economics at Indiana University, approached us with his interest in co-commissioning an economics series of economics papers, I felt we had the right occasion. Too often, arts research gets sneered at by other kinds of researchers as not serious. And too often, those of us in the arts leadership positions leave the research just sitting on the shelf. I think today we'll go a long way toward changing both of these. These are serious academics who've approached important topics with rigor. And we've invited colleagues from across the federal government, the Patent and Trademark Office, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and the Department of Housing and Urban Development. We invited them to join with us here at the Brookings Institute to talk about how this work relates to the real world and its policy implications. Within our Office of Research and Analysis, a white paper was one of the another one of the early things we did. The white paper was commissioned from Ann Markison, who I think is right here. It's an incredible paper. Those of you who haven't read it should, by all means. But it was a white paper on creative placemaking. And it led to our signature NEA initiative, the Our Town grant program. Our look at the data within the Survey of Public Participation in the arts about America's arts consumption via electronic media led to changes we recently made to our arts in media grant guidelines. So we do take research seriously, and we do use it in our policy. And James Catterall's arts education research that we published has helped the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities as they implement their Turnaround Arts Initiative that integrates arts education into overall school reform strategies. So I'm very excited to see what the result of today's conversations will be. Before I turn things back over to Bruce, so that we can begin the conversation with creative clustering, there are three NEA colleagues whom I would like to single out for today's during today's meetings. Sunil Iyengar, Bonnie Nichols, and Ellen Grantham. I would also like to acknowledge the work, the great work, that all of Bruce's colleagues at Brookings and, of course, Michael Rushton and Indiana University, the work that they've all done to make this possible. So let me leave things there and ask Bruce to come back up in his moderator's hat to get us started. Thanks so much. Bruce.
So first thing, there's a Twitter hashtag, NEA Brookings, if you want to tweet to the millions. If you mention, you know, David Byrne or something, maybe people will pay attention. What we're going to try to do is have three presentations in a row, 15 minutes each. I would say to each of the presenters, both for this panel and for the next panel, there will be a timekeeper. And so when they put up that 5-minute, 10-minute, don't sneer, don't, you know, attack, follow the rules. So we're going to start with Juan Mateos Garcia. He's a research fellow at the National Endowment for Science, Technology, and Arts in the UK, a paper entitled Capital of Culture. Then we're going to go to Stephen Shepherd. He's a professor of economics at Williams College. His paper is titled Culture Shocks and Consequences. And then we'll end up with Charles Gray, professor of business economics, University of St. Thomas, paper title, Provocative, The Arts as a Growth Engine. So we'll start with Juan, and then everyone will sort of move through, keeping time, and then we'll moderate a conversation.
Hi, everyone. My name is Juan Mateos. I'm a research fellow at NESTA, and I'm here to present the emerging findings from a research project that I've been working on with my colleague Hassan Bakshi at NESTA and Neil Lee, senior economist at the Work Foundation in London. This paper is called Capital of Culture, and it explores the relationship between cultural clustering and productivity in English cities. What is the motivation for this work? The motivation for this work is that over the last decades, we have seen very strong emphasis being placed on arts and culture as drivers of economic development. We have seen wonderful buildings being erected. This is the Sage Gate set in Newcastle. We have been cities competing in festivals to become capitals of culture. This is Liverpool. Got it for 2009. We have seen a plethora of arts and cultural activities taking place in different cities. This has been very visible in England. This photo is actually from a festival that takes place in Brighton, where I live. So it's around us. And as economists and people who are concerned with cultural policy, we have decided to look a bit at the evidence base underpinning all this policy making. Basically, we want to look at how robust is the relationship between arts and culture and local productivity. And we also wanted to try to identify through which mechanisms are the arts and culture impacting on local economic development, because only that way we'll be able to enforce policymaking in this area. So the structure is simple and very academic. We have a theory, a number of theories setting out connections between arts, culture, and economic development. We are going to be examining whether the evidence supports those different theories using methods and data, which I will be telling you about. Going to be presenting some emerging findings from the research, and then I'm going to be presenting the conclusions and next steps of the work. This, I must emphasize, is a work in progress. The findings are emergent, and our in terms of policy, we have implications rather than recommendations. But we set out to address that by doing more things with the data, which I will be telling you about to conclude. So what's the theory? What is the role of the arts and culture in our cities? Two main theories have been set out. The first one presents arts and culture as providers of amenities, as providers of atmospheres, experiences, basically, a number of things that high human capital, highly talented, highly innovative, skilled people are looking for when they decide where to move. By attracting those people who are referred to as the creative class, the arts and culture contribute to economic development because the presence of a strong creative class then attracts high growth, innovative, high tech, knowledge intensive business firms, the sort of firms that everyone seems to be after. So this is one model. Another reason why the arts and culture are seen to be attractive for the creative class is because they act as proxies for atmospheres of tolerance and openness to which it's argued the creative class is attractive. The other way of thinking about the impact of arts and culture on economic development is through localized spillovers, where investments undertaken by arts and culture, through their own activities, they make firms in cities more productive. How do they do this? They do this by investing on human capital, highly skilled, innovative people that then are employed in other sectors. They do this by providing organizational templates for innovation that can be imitated by other firms around them. They do this by creating atmospheres which are conducive to collaboration and knowledge sharing. And they do this very importantly, and perhaps in a way which is harder to measure, by creating expressive value, creating new histories, creating new symbols, creating new aesthetics, which are in some cases commercialized in other parts of the economy. And basically, the way these spillovers are generally described in the literature is taking place, taking short leaps, as it were. What we see, labor flows, what we see this imitation taking place is mostly between arts and culture and other sectors in what we will call the commercial creative economy, sectors such as publishing, sectors such as music, software publishing and video games, digital media and so forth. And this is represented by that concentric circles model over there in that box. So this is the theory. There are many open questions about these different explanations of the impact of arts and culture on economic development. In the first story, best represented by Richard Florida's Creative Cities framework, there are many questions about the direction of causality between arts and culture and the creative class. Is it that arts and culture genuinely attract these high human capital professionals, or is it that these human capital professionals are able to support a vibrant arts and cultural scene? Does it even make sense to talk about the creative class as a monolithic construct? Are arts, designers, advertising people, software developers, engineers, lawyers part of the same class? There's been many criticisms to this framework for making that assumption about all these people deciding to move to places and making those decisions to move to places on the same basis, even having the same goals. In terms of the localized spillovers research, we have a small number of suggestive studies, rarely looking at the spatial dimension, and they haven't really looked much at what's the relative importance of these different spillovers in creating economic impacts. Again, a question which is very important for policy. Something else where there's a question is about whether it is industries, that is sectors, or people who create impacts. And also there's a dearth of research looking at these relationships between arts and culture and economic development outside of the US. In particular, in England, the situation is not great. I was doing some background work on this, and the main piece of work I could find was an MSc dissertation looking at this issue. So we are really trying to bridge that gap through our research. So what's the method and what's our data? Basically, we set out to explore empirically the relationships between cultural clustering and local productivity in 74 English cities. Our model is fairly straightforward. We look at worker wages, and we try to explain those on the basis of the presence of a cultural cluster in the city where those workers live. We measure cultural clustering using three different metrics of industries or sectors, occupations, and institutions, arts and cultural institutions. When we talk about culture, we talk about not-for-profit activities, including museums, including libraries, and including things such as visual and performing arts. So basically, this is not including what we would call the commercial cultural industries. And of course, we also include another set of variables which could explain these worker wages. We explain individual characteristics such as skills and human capital, experience, socio-demographic variables. And we also include variables, characteristics of cities that could also explain the wages of the workers who live there. We are controlling for all these things. Our data comes from official surveys of workers, official surveys of businesses, and a unique data set of 5,000 cultural institutions compiled by Culture 24, which is a UK-based organization whose website you can visit at that URL. Basically, what we're exploring is simple. It's whether we find, after controlling for all these different individual and city variables, whether we find a positive impact of cultural clustering on worker wages. This would suggest the existence of spillovers. Still, we would need to address the issue of causality, that is, whether it is the case that places where workers are more productive and get paid higher wages are more supportive on cultural clusters. But that's going to be one for next steps, as I'll talk about when I finish the paper. The presentation, sorry. So what are our findings? When we plot hourly wages against cultural clustering, we find a positive relationship. We find that people living in places with high levels of cultural clustering get paid higher hourly wages. This is 1.11 pounds an hour. That's what workers in cities in the 90th cultural percentile earn above those in cities in the 10th percentile. And this is amounts, I think, to around 170 pounds a month. So it's a substantial amount, actually. However, and this is reflected in this first list of correlation results, where we simply find that cultural clustering has a positive impact on hourly wages across the board. And this is for all the different measures of cultural clustering, including occupations, employment, and institutions. However, when we include individual variables into our model, we find that the results become mixed and some impacts become insignificant. And in the case of cultural employment and cultural institutions, it becomes significant and negative. This becomes even clearer when we introduce measures of cities. Basically, what this means is that once we control for individual and city characteristics, people living in cultural clusters get paid less on average than those in other places. We interpret this as evidence of the contribution that arts and culture make to quality of life and place. People are willing, will basically be happy to sacrifice some salary in order to live in live and work in places with strong arts and culture. We have also looked at whether there are any... We find that people living in cities with strong commercial creative clusters get paid more on average once we control for all these individual and city-level characteristics, whether there's a creative city premium, as it were, from living in places with strong media, entertainment, and digital clusters. And in this case, we do find basically the... For some reason, this is showing us negative, but they're actually positive coefficients. There's indeed, once we control, even controlling for individual and city-level characteristics, workers in creative cities get paid above the average. And this is particularly the case for people working in creative occupation clusters rather than creative industry clusters. Of course, an issue that we need to address here is whether there's a reverse causality, again, where places which are more affluent attract these creative clusters. The third thing that we examine, our fourth key finding, I think, is where we explore whether the spillovers from arts and culture are more constrained. You know, they are taking those shorter leaps, so maybe we don't see them captured in the wages of the wider economy, but we see them captured in the wages of people working in these commercial creative occupations. So basically, we look at this by looking at the interactions between cultural clustering and whether a worker is on a creative occupation or not. What this is telling us is very simple. It's whether... If I am a creative worker, does it make a difference for my wages to live in a place with a strong arts and cultural cluster? And the results that we find suggest that this is indeed the case, which basically would support the idea that arts and culture generate spillovers which are beneficial for those people who are basically closer to that arts and culture. They work in commercial creative industries. And as I showed before, those people seem to have an impact on the wider economy through that creative wage premium. So what this suggests is that arts and culture might be having an indirect impact on the local economy by impacting on that creative economy around it. So the tentative conclusions coming out from this research. In the first place, we find that quality of life and place aspects, that their important quality of life and place aspects to arts and cultural infrastructure is not simply a matter of trying to build a creative city and expecting high-wage people to move in. Actually, it might be the case that you get very smart people wanting to move in and getting paid less for it, which might actually make local companies more competitive, which is, again, a beneficial impact, but not through the usual mechanism. Also, we find evidence of creative wage premiums for creative occupations. And finally, we find evidence of spillovers between arts and culture and commercial creative digital sector. This suggests that policymakers, when developing creative city policies, should pay attention to the ecosystem aspects of the cultural and creative infrastructure and the connections between arts, culture, and the commercial creative industries. In terms of next steps, this is a snapshot of work in progress. We have lots to do yet. In particular, we are going to be including more variables in our analysis. The elephant in this particular room is housing prices, which we didn't manage to include in time for this presentation. We are also going to be looking at firm-level productivity data as well as worker wages as another way of getting at the relationship between arts and cultural clustering and productivity. And we're also planning to explore causality using longitudinal historical data as well as instrumental variables and maybe also a natural experiment using the implementation of free access policies to English museums in the UK. So I look forward to the discussion coming. Thank you very much. And that's my email. Thanks.
Thank you. This project is reporting on a paper, a research paper that's really joint product with myself and my colleague Peter Pedroni. The URLs that are there at the bottom of the screen, c-3-d.org/slides.pdf or paper.pdf, can be used to download on your smartphone or anything that'll read Acrobat. Copy of these slides and a copy of the paper. So what's motivating this research is probably what's motivating most of you for being in this room. Does culture production affect the economy? In some sense, the answer to this is obvious. Culture production is part of the local economy, and when it takes place, it contributes to the level of local economic activity. There have been many studies that demonstrated this. Some of the most interesting and important done by folks here in the room and people who are on the panel later on. The point we want to focus on, however, is not just does it affect broadly, but does culture production result? Is there a causal connection between culture production and economic growth? So does an increase in culture, a shock to culture production, result in a change in long-run income? That's really effectively asking, is the creative economy a source or a byproduct of a growing economy? And this is exactly the question Juan was posing and discussing in part of the previous paper. Now, you might say, wait, hasn't this already been demonstrated? I mean, look at this relationship. Here is a graph for 384 MSAs in the U.S. of the relationship between local per capita GDP and per capita arts and culture production in the not-for-profit sector, a clear, unambiguous relationship. Case solved, right? Well, the problem is this relationship exists for many sectors. So here's the relationship between new car dealerships and local per capita GDP. None of us would think, some of us might think, I mean, GM would like to urge us to think that what's good for GM is good for the U.S., and so we should be, like, you know, boosting the local new car dealers, and that will result in additional GDP. But most of us suspect that the reason that this relationship exists is because more affluent communities, more affluent economies, people buy more cars. Correlation does not imply causation. That's the issue that we're confronting. And to sort this out, what we need is a clear model supported by empirical validation that can examine these causal relationships. Now, there have been many studies that have looked at this relationship, input-output models and multipliers. Look at these. There are a variety of problems with that approach. I don't want to belabor all of those. Some of those are interesting, and they're quite appropriate if our main focus is on the short-run impact. The problem is such approaches do not really address the long-run impact on the economy. So what we want to do in this paper is to present a model that accounts for the opportunity costs associated with culture production. If we devote more resources to culture production, there's going to be fewer resources for something else because it's a finite world we live in. We want to allow but not require that culture causes growth and then empirically test for this causal relationship. So to do this, we set up what economists would recognize as a classic endogenous growth model that relates income, that relates the value of goods and services produced in the economy, Y, to the amount of capital available in that economy, K, the amount of culture production, C, and the amount of labor. A scales the factor productivity, so it represents technological change, but in this is an endogenous growth model. We're not using technological change to drive growth. Rather, we're using the accumulation of capital and the production of culture. We're investigating their ability to drive growth in the economy. So in our model, culture production is subject to shocks. So this is the kind of shocks that you might imagine would happen naturally in the world of philanthropy. A large gift comes in an unexpected way, and that can boost culture production in a local community or local economy. That is important for us because we can then observe those shocks to culture production and trace out over time what happens to local GDP. In that way, we can sort out the causal connection between culture production and the prosperity of the local economy. So do positive shocks to culture generate changes in steady state income? If we mess around algebraically with the model, and some details of that are in the paper that you can download, we can express the economy, the relationship, as one between per capita GDP as a function of total factor productivity, A. These terms involving S and tau are the shares of local income, local GDP, that are devoted to culture production. So when tau rises, this term, the term there that's got the arrow presented to, pointing to it, shares of income devoted to culture, when that rises, more local income is devoted to culture production. And, of course, labor growth is also an important factor. So we're trying to sort out and separate out the effects of culture production from the other things that drive local GDP. In this model, we can show that the log of per capita income and log of culture production have a nice statistical property that's called having a unit root. Econometricians get really excited when they see things have unit root, even more excited when they discover two things that are what's called co-integrated, which means they move randomly, but they tend to move together, intuitively speaking. And it turns out that when series are co-integrated, one must cause the other, or both cause each other. So we're able to show, in fact, that either income causes culture production or culture production causes income to change, or both. And we're going to explore how that process works. What's also true in this model is that there's actually an optimal growth-maximizing amount of culture production for the city. So if your whole goal was just to produce economic impact, you can solve for a particular level of culture production, tau star, that would maximize growth. That's not the only reason we support culture production in a society, but there is a growth-maximizing level of culture production. And for cities that are below that level, a positive shock to culture is going to increase income. And for cities that are above that level, a positive shock to culture actually could decrease income. So we investigate whether these data are consistent with the model that we've laid out. We test the hypotheses that per capita income and per capita culture production have a unit root and test whether they're integrated. Doing that it requires us to estimate what's called a co-integrating relationship. This expresses the amount of culture production as a function of the amount of per capita income. And so when we see a large E, a large error term, what that means is you've identified a city with more culture production than you would expect given its income. That then gets used, that observation gets used in estimating what's called an error correction model. And from that error correction model, we can determine the direction of causality and the significance of the impacts. We use data that we've obtained from the NCCS for cultural nonprofits localized to each city. This represents the time series of data. We have information for 384 MSAs in the U.S., and we look at total culture production as measured by the total expenditures of all arts and culture nonprofits located within the MSA. If you're an econometrician, you'll get and do panel time series econometrics, you'll be all excited and interested in these statistics. But let me just tell you that all of the stars next to those tests imply that all the tests show that the data are consistent with the predictions of our model. So it suggests that these data are appropriate to apply this model to. We can then test causality, and the details of this test are in the paper, but I can tell you that these tests imply that there is a pervasive causal connection between per capita culture production and per capita GDP in U.S. metropolitan economies. The direction is unambiguous that income causes culture, but also there's evidence that culture causes income. When we apply the sign test, the sign test that we have, what we're able to establish is that for the majority of U.S. metropolitan areas, a positive shock to culture generates an increase in per capita GDP. And this is actually a causal connection because it tracks in time. So we're able to analyze it by using information over time. So, I don't know if I've great. I'm on schedule for my conclusion slide. What do we establish? First, there is a clear short-run relationship between culture production and economic output that's obvious from the fact that culture production is part of the economy. Neither that relationship nor the overall size of the cultural sector, however, implies that increases in art support will necessarily cause economic growth or increases in long-run GDP. Evaluation of that requires a new type of model and data analysis that goes over time so that we can trace out these impacts. In this paper, we provide a growth model in which these shocks to culture might generate economic growth. Using data from U.S. culture, arts and culture nonprofits, we find that the data are consistent with the predictions of our model, that arts and culture production has a pervasive causal impact on steady state income or GDP in metropolitan economies. Therefore, a positive shock to culture production causes economic growth in the overall sample of cities. That won't necessarily be true in subsets of cities, and the paper itself includes some information about how that breaks down in particular regional contexts, and we're investigating in other contexts. So in this sense, we can truly say that art works. Okay, thank you.
Good morning. Well, you heard Juan talk about the need for and the provision of a theoretical connection between the arts and the local economy. So there is a first step, at least, toward fleshing out what we've acknowledged for quite some time has been a shortcoming. What is really the theoretical connection? And you heard Steve talk about a need for a follow-up looking at more of a longer-term perspective, some more time series research. The good news is that I do have a little bit of that. The bad news is that I can't offer much more confirming evidence than he does. But at least we're beginning to make some strides in that, what I think is the right direction. So this research, the arts as a growth engine, actually has quite a long history. I began doing this back in the early 90s, partly as a response to what at the time, as you will see as we proceed into this presentation, the contention that the arts were in fact a growth engine and that simply by funding more of the arts, the local economies throughout the country would prosper, and the arts would be a cause of that. Well, economists tend not to, well, we're skeptics. We are natural skeptics. We think in terms of, well, what do we sacrifice to do that? Is there really a theoretical foundation for what you're claiming to be the case? But we didn't do much testing of those claims back in the very early days. So the economic impact of the arts is a significant element of historic arts advocacy. It still is an element of arts advocacy. And early on, it was founded on what is known as the export-based theory, whereby spending on the arts in a local economy has some multiplier effects that work their way through the rest of the economy. And this little equation simply says that total employment or other indicators of economic activity in a local economy is some multiple of arts-based economic activity in that area. And you'll be hearing some more about the export-based approach as we proceed through the day. Some fundamental drawbacks of this approach. The first is the assumption that the arts sector is part of the export base. That is to say that people come to a community specifically to purchase arts-related services. And yes, that happens. But is that significant enough to count as a cause of local economic growth? The second piece of an economist's response to this is that even if it's true, does it really justify a subsidy? And if it does justify subsidy, well, there are other sectors of the economy which are much more important in terms of promoting local economic growth. Does that suggest that they should be subsidized as well? And finally, if we're focusing on this as a subsidy argument, are we diverting attention from sounder reasons for subsidizing the arts? And I termed this, by the way, since it just doesn't go away, as the zombie justification. Well, the next stage in the effort to link the arts to local economic activity is what we call the quality of life argument. And you heard Juan sketch this out as well. The idea is that the arts, as part of the local quality of life in a community, attracts and retains employees in the community. But the preponderance of evidence suggests that business decisions are focused on other important factors, whether there's a skilled workforce, whether there's access to markets or access to suppliers, and the extent to which the local governments provide infrastructure investments. The most recent approach, which is the focus of our symposium today, is the endogenous growth aspect. And I provided here a somewhat simpler version of Steve's more complex growth model or production function as it is presented here, where it simply states that local economic activity or local output, signified by Q here, is some function of the capital and labor. And then I have an A there as an augmentation by the arts community. Now, one of the issues that has arisen in the so-called new growth theory is that it's subject to increasing returns. While economists like for things to settle down to an equilibrium growth path, it enables us to use our mathematics to predict some outcomes. And one of the realities of the new growth theory is that things do not, in fact, settle down to an equilibrium growth path, that things are what are sometimes referred to as state-dependent, that random shocks can generate effects that don't wash out over time but, in fact, can amplify over time. And that might be, and I'll give you a little bit of a advanced look here, that might account at least in part for some of the diverse results that we find in our research. So, you'll hear Richard Florida's name mentioned several times again during the day, because his work back in the early 2000s did in fact reinvigorate the economic impact arguments, shifted them a bit away from the old export base approach to something very different. He does mention one of the prime drivers, Paul Romer, of the new growth theory, but he mentions it only in passing. So I would have to contend that while Florida's work is certainly challenging and stimulating, we can't really conclude that it is firmly based in our subject matter today. Nonetheless, arts advocates, including many of you, found this to be a very attractive aspect to incorporate in our advocacy activities. However, we have up to this point had uncertain theoretical and empirical support for this. And I wish I could say that as a result of today's work and the things that you will hear, we've solved that problem. We're making progress. So here's the question that I pursued. Does, and you've heard this mentioned already, you'll hear it mentioned a few more times before the day is over, does the arts sector in some sense cause local economic growth, or is the arts sector a response to local economic growth? The latter of those two is the traditional economics perspective. The former of those two might be incorporated into the new economic development approach. So the way it's phrased here is that the export base approach, the arts sector, if the arts is basic and the arts stimulates visitors to a community who will purchase arts services and products, is an element of the larger export base, then that should cause, in a sense, or it should drive overall economic activity, signified here by E sub T. On the other hand, if the arts, as part of a growth-stimulating culture sector, drives local economic growth, then we'd have the arrow indicated pointing to the Q in the second bullet-pointed equation. I used a technique that has been around in economics for quite a long time now, has resulted in someone else winning a Nobel Prize. But I'm not hesitant about riding on those coattails. So the question becomes, how much of current economic activity can be explained by past values of current economic activity? And then is that enhanced by putting in the arts sector as a supplementary representation of cause? Without burdening you with the processes and techniques themselves, I'll simply note that if the economic base is a sound approach, the export base is a sound approach to explaining local economic activity, then within a fairly short period of time, we should have some indication that the arts are having an impact on the local economy. If, however, if we adopt the endogenous growth approach, the new growth theory approach, it takes far more time for that to work its way out. And I'm using a longer time period. The time periods that I use are years. And so I'm looking at whether there is, over a fairly short period of time of 4 years, whether that's sufficient for a stimulus, an arts-generated stimulus, to work its way through the local economy and show an impact. Over 8 years, does arts-related economic activity generate enough of an impact on local growth to show up? I use 15 metropolitan areas. And I used income by source, where I could approximate the arts-related income with three aggregations of sectors. I looked at entertainment, okay, which is not exactly the arts. I looked at movies, which is borderline the arts. And I looked at museums, zoos. Well, the zoo's artistic. Well, they're grouped together with museums and so on. So using those sectors and linking those to the local economies in these metropolitan areas listed alphabetically. Of course, now I live in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis-St. Paul. I knew what I expected to happen there. And here are the results. So just summarizing the consequences here. Is there evidence of arts-induced export-base impact? And in 5 of the 15 metropolitan areas, there was such evidence. Dallas, Houston, Minneapolis, St. Paul, New York City, and Philadelphia. And intuitively, I think we can understand some of these. New York City and Broadway. It just makes some sense that some of us travel to New York City and go to Broadway shows for the purpose of attending those Broadway productions and other arts amenities, to go to MoMA, to go to the Met, and so on. Philadelphia makes some sense, I think, to most of us, because as the seat of our historical development has a number of cultural amenities that we visit over the years. Dallas and Houston, I'm still working on exactly what's going on there. Minneapolis, St. Paul, I like to think, and of course this is purely anecdotal, and it's fostered by a number of decades of living there. Founded by Nordic folks who were indoors much of the year and needed something to do, and so, of course, developed those artistic amenities. Is there evidence of arts-induced endogenous growth? Well, in 3 of the 15 metropolitan areas, there's evidence of that. Atlanta, Dallas, and Minneapolis-St. Paul. Dallas shows up again for reasons, again, I'm working with. And the Twin Cities, well, of course. The local cultural community does, in fact, if it doesn't attract, it certainly retains businesses. And we get a lot of strong evidence from local business leaders that that is the case. Evidence that the arts respond to growth, this is the predominant outcome, that the arts respond to increases in local economic activity, increases in local ability to spend, and a lot of that spending goes on the arts. We think of the arts as what we call, however necessary the arts are in your life, economists do find that they act as what we call luxury goods. That is, our income rises, spending on the arts goes up faster. On a percentage basis. So, not powerful evidence, but lots of opportunity to plumb the depths further. What needs to be done? I'd like to do this on additional metropolitan areas. Maybe not quite as many as Steve. I don't have that much time before retirement to collect that much data. I'd like to experiment some more with sectoral definitions and data access. There are some lingering data shortcomings, including the fact that because of disclosure rules, we don't always get all the data for all the counties and all the metropolitan areas, especially as metropolitan areas grow, and trying to get historical data for those. And then I'd like to explore some more control variables. What else is happening? So we have some evidence for some cities of arts having an impact, more evidence for more metropolitan areas of the arts being responsive to local economic activity. Thank you.
Okay. So show of hands, how many people took economics in college? That's pretty impressive. How many people have graduate degrees in economics? Well, I was going to say, though this seems to be a much more economically based group, welcome to Brookings. You know? I found that an absolutely fascinating set of presentations, past the methodology bit. But what I'd like to do, and then open up for questions, is... because I know everyone had a chance to talk with each other yesterday about, obviously, the methodology, but also the findings. And before I ask a series of questions, were there any sort of outcomes from those conversations among the three of you in terms of what you found? Any sort of clear common ground, either about the starting theory or about some of the findings? I mean, at Brookings, we will always say, we need more research. These are American jobs, right? But any sort of insights from the conversations you all had yesterday, either during the day, I know you had a dinner together, that you might want to share with the audience?
Actually, regretfully, I wasn't able to make it.
Okay, then you can hypothesize, though.
We have already been talking about this.
Anyone else want
to? I'll take a shot at least a piece of it. And actually, Steve mentioned something which I think we might be looking for. He mentioned shocks to the to the local economy. Mm-hmm. And it would be nice if we could find sort of natural experiments and track the results of such shocks. And I'm actually have something that I'm pursuing, which I think might turn out to be something close to that. Some of you may be aware that as a result of a misguided political position of a former governor of Minnesota, who, by the way, was a failed presidential candidate, whose position was no new taxes. And the electorate said, oh, yes, we're going to have new taxes. And the electorate proposed and enacted an amendment to the Minnesota State Constitution, thereby effectively overriding the no new taxes stance of the former governor. A piece of that amendment, which is known as the Legacy Amendment, was funding dedicated to art and culture. It happened to be one of those odd bedfellows, political bedfellows things. The arts advocates united with environmentalists and hunters to divide up the proceeds of the new taxes. But we will be tracking the impact of the revenues raised and the types of spending in local communities throughout Minnesota. So we have at least the option of an experiment.
Very interesting. What I enjoyed about these presentations was the ability to disaggregate what could be a very large, almost simplistic conversation about the impact, causation, correlation, arts and culture in the economy, into these different sort of buckets, essentially. Traction, retention, the spillovers, export versus response. The question about arts and culture, I mean, you said, for example, one of the criticisms of the creative class work, and Richard's not here to defend himself, but we can call him up, maybe he'll live tweet, is that it has sort of an almost monolithic kind of sense and sort of mixing and matching up of lawyers, you know, engineers, designers, people we would regard as pure artists, right? So very large class. Mm-hmm. The same way, I'd like just to get your sense, in a particular city, and everyone here has their own sense of, you know, whether in England or in the United States, arts and culture covers many different kinds of large interventions, right? The museums, the cultural institutions, the entertainment sector, and then very small kind of firms, individuals, free agents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. One of the most persistent questions we get, and I think your research is beginning to help us sort through this a bit better, is how do you distinguish between support for either legacy or continued for these large cultural institutions, and particularly the buildings, right? I mean, you can go to many places in the United States and see a spurt of performing art facilities being built, and the sort of smaller interventions, right? Probably less costly at the end of the day, but less predictive. Hard to get your arms around it, right? There's no ribbon to cut, you know? So how do you think about that? Because I think it sort of disaggregates even further what is this large arts and culture kind of cluster. Any thoughts?
One of the advantages, it's both an advantage and a shortcoming of our Culture 24 data set, is just a self-selecting database that doesn't account for the size of the cultural institution which is registering.
I see.
So we literally have there from communities, organizations running on a shoestring to very large and well-funded museums. And we're still finding an impact on that variable. It's not really looking at the amount of employment on cultural sectors in a given place. It's just looking at what's going on in terms of cultural institutions registering for the data set. And as the results suggest, as I said, tentatively, we're finding both effects in terms of this apparent compensating differential as well as the spillovers between, again, tentative spillovers between arts and cultural activity and creative occupation wages.
Yeah. We've been very interested in trying to disaggregate, as you said, and look at the impacts on the local economy that result from different types of arts and cultural organizations. We are constrained because we've been working with nonprofit data, so we're kind of leaving aside the commercial sector. But a large hunk of arts and culture production is happening within the nonprofit world in the U.S. So with the available data that's coming from the 990s that we can get, we can separate out impacts of performing arts, visual arts, and other arts organizations. We've undertaken some preliminary investigations of that. And we can also just broadly separate them into groups of big organizations, small organizations. It would be really great to sort out the capital expenditure impacts from the operating expenditure impacts. That's a little less reliably extractable from the 990 information, but to the extent that it's there, we could look at that. We haven't looked at the capital versus operating.
Yeah, this really raises the larger data availability question.
Right.
And there's two kinds of implications of that for economic impact analyses. The data availability, for example, Steve's working with nonprofit data from the Form 990s. Until last year, very small organizations never had to file a 990, yet in the aggregate, they can be significant in a local economy. They get lost entirely, and suddenly it's a shock to the system, but it's a legislatively induced shock or policy induced shock rather than a natural economic development kind of shock. The other aspect that I think is worth thinking about is you talked about aggregating data, and we've talked about aggregating across sectors and so on, but there really are several other dimensions, and I'll just mention two. One is the difference between how the arts and cultural sector impacts the local economy as a whole and where are the boundaries of the art and cultural sector, about which there's some disagreement, and then how does an arts district impact the location of economic activity within a community, which is a very different question. Both of those have impacts for the quality of life in a community.
Very interesting. Right. Mm.
I was just going to say, first, let me second every social scientist's complaint of, yes, more data would be helpful. Mm-hmm. And, for example, the ability to bring in the commercial sector. With the 990 information, though, because that has Z+4s for virtually all organizations, we can look at clusters within urban areas, and we're just starting analysis of that to look at how whether having clustered versus dispersed arts and culture production has a different impact on long-run GDP in the cities.
Let me ask you this question. I was in Ohio yesterday, and Brookings released a study on the spatial geography of manufacturing. Okay, a completely different kind of cluster. Now, obviously involves many creative people, particularly in the industrial design community, right? Mm-hmm. If you think about the cluster, so let's just focus on Northeast Ohio for a second. The very large firms, sort of your base, you've got this sort of network of small and medium-sized firms that are the suppliers to the large firms. And then you've got this ecosystem. Mm-hmm. It's a very rich ecosystem of advanced research institutions, of labor skilling intermediaries, right, that are sort of feeder systems into the firms, advocacy organizations. I mean, it's really interesting about how rich and textured that cluster is. So we're calling this a cluster of sorts, right? But as you think about the broader economy, is there something different about how arts and culture operates? Is it an ecosystem, right? Seems a bit different from automotive or aerospace or high-precision medical devices, which is a big cluster, obviously, in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and so forth and so on. So is there something different about this? And would that affect ultimately results in terms of economic impact and so forth?
I'm actually involved in a project, a two-year project, looking at the creative digital and cultural cluster in Brighton, which is where the assessor.
Sure.
And it's very much going to be looking at these sorts of issues, including testing hypotheses about the extent to which arts, skills, resources, and so forth are complementary with more conventional, commercially creative and digital resources, as well as the extent to which the network is connected.
Right.
That is, we find arts and cultural organizations working with creative commercial companies in the way in which you would expect a cluster to behave.
Right.
Anecdotal evidence suggests a connection. Also, not in terms of labor flows and also in terms of trade.
I mean, there has to be some impact of clustering in arts and culture production because we observe a lot of clustering.
Right.
I mean, even in that region, in Toledo is a great example where the Toledo Museum of Art is located, you know, has been there for a long time. Right next to it is built the University of Toledo's art school. And so, you know, we see this over and over again in metropolitan areas, clustering of production of different types of cultural activities. What's a little unclear, but is a great question to be investigating, right, is what is the impact of that clustering? How does that clustering affect the way that arts and culture affects the metropolitan economy? And how does that clustering affect the success or struggling sustainability of the cultural organizations themselves? Getting a handle on what that incentive is to cluster. It's a great question. I think we're starting to be able to look at that. We've done a little work, again, with the nonprofit data. There's been lots of stuff, of course, looking at arts and culture districts. I mean, the NEA sponsored some of that stuff. There's
something that we sometimes lose track of, I suspect, when we're comparing, say, manufacturing with the arts. Manufacturing firms very often are multi-site
right.
firms.
Right.
Arts organizations almost always are single-site firms. So, for example, a decision made in Detroit has a powerful impact in St. Paul, Minnesota, to close the Ford plant there. There are no decisions made in Detroit that have an impact on the Minneapolis Institute of Arts. We have not yet, I suspect, done enough work on the nature of the local arts industry. In fact, I'm only aware of a single such study, an in-depth analysis of an arts industry, and that was in a smaller Dutch community. And nothing, to my knowledge, yet has been done in the U.S., and that probably is something we need to remedy.
Another question, and then folks should get ready. You know, I left my iPhone upstairs, so this is a BlackBerry, right? It's just not. I hope this doesn't go out of service because I like the way it's raised, you know, so you can type. But anyway, we see how fast things happen in this world today. I find what's remarkable over the past literally 5 years of how much visual design has entered our everyday lives, right? And it just strikes me that as we try to assess the impacts of arts and culture, and maybe this is just a segment of the arts and cultural community, this spillover issue, right, if we look back, may not have as dramatic of an effect. But as we begin to think about the effect of these mobile devices and iPads and all the rest of it on our lives, it seems like there's almost an acceleration of the interplay of design and communication and how it fundamentally affects how firms across multiple sectors, not just think about how they communicate and brand and extend their reach, but how they actually do their work. And so that sort of leads you to think that whatever we're observing today, if we play out this over the next 10 or 15 years, and obviously we're not talking about everywhere in the United States, but we're talking about a very specific set of places, we could be seeing much bigger observable effects. And I just want to are we living in such a disruptive and dynamic period that we have to reassess or just maybe just come back and get more clear and granular about how we think about this interplay? Thoughts? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it is true that the importance of design has injected itself in a big way in terms of personal electronic devices and communications devices and that sort of thing. But design, of course,
right.
I mean, urban design has been important in how we live our lives for centuries. Fashion has been important in how we signal to each other status and interest and et cetera. So it may be that there are stages at which a particular industry or group of consumption items mature to where design is ready to become an important factor in helping us decide how, where, and in what ways to use particular objects.
But this is ubiquitous in many ways. I mean, this cuts across class, race, ethnicity in a way that urban design I don't think ever has, right? I mean, this is now a platform for how we all live our lives and how companies operate. It just strikes me as a radical shift, and then allows for these spillovers, allows for this mashup of clusters in ways that we may not have anticipated before or experienced before.
And some of the research that Nesta has done has looked at the extent to which one finds people from creative occupations working outside the conventionally defined creative industries,
right.
using the Department for Culture, Media, and Sports definition, and we find that 60% are working outside the creative industries. They are what we call embedded creative professionals working elsewhere in the economy. Designers, musicians, all sorts of advertising, of course.
So there's hope for my daughter, is really what you're telling.
Well, and I think what is definitely true is when design becomes important, then of necessity, clustering is important.
Right.
Because then we're learning so much just by being in proximity to each other and to the goods themselves.
And we should acknowledge the symbiotic relationship. There was this wonderful piece in Business Week not too long ago about an auto parts designer who lost his job when the industry shrank. The industry is beginning to grow again. He got an offer of a new job. But in the very short time that he was unemployed, technology changed entirely, design technology. He had to totally retrain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Open up for questions. Now, I have specifically avoided any methodological questions, right? but if anyone in this audience is so moved, please feel free. Question over here.
Sure. Thanks. Thanks very much. This is very interesting.
And identify yourself if you can.
I'm going to identify myself. I'm Stephen Canna. I am one of those people who raised his hand as an economist with all three degrees. I worked for the Treasury Department and the U.S. Council for International Business, and now I'm retired. You all raise interesting points, particularly Professor Shepard about opportunity costs you mentioned, and Professor Gray talked about whether it's a driver of growth or a recipient of growth. Which brings us back to sort of some economic principles, and that is, if I can take you out of the weeds, when we allocate resources, we allocate resources through the price mechanism, and prices reflect relative relationships, not absolute relationships. So, gentlemen, in this area of scarce resources today, if you are the mayor of a city or the head of a city council, and the head of the arts council comes to you and says, we want to spend $5 million to extend the museum. And the parents of the PTA come to you and say, no, we want to spend $5 million to have more class time, AP math, phys ed so our kids are not overweight and get near diabetic. How do you choose? I would put to you that you cannot ignore this aspect of work, of the relative price of the arts and the benefits which they convey to our economy and our society versus the other claim on resources. I'd be interested in your comments.
Great question.
I mean, I couldn't agree with you more, and it's exactly what our paper's about. So all I can say is please
go to the URL.
Equations.
Okay, well, let me just say it is exactly what motivated us to do this research. And I think the answer is there are broad classes of cities in which the mayor, if the mayor's primary concern is maximizing the economic output of the metropolitan region, there are large classes of cities for which the answer is yes, we should go ahead and put money for the arts, and that may mean less for the classrooms or less for roadways or less for some other bit of infrastructure. There are other classes of cities for which that's not true and where the money, again, for purposes of maximizing local GDP, where the money would be more appropriately spent on infrastructure development. And by developing and estimating these models, we can identify the class of activities, the class of cities, the characteristics that will provide guidance. Of course, maximizing GDP isn't the only reason we support the arts, but as an input to the decision-making process, we can provide that.
Bruce, the question you ask, and you mentioned two specific sectors for comparison, it actually is the single most significant question confronting the entire nonprofit sector, or set of sectors, subsectors at the moment. Mm-hmm. And if one goes to research a symposia, a seminar, and the like, scholars who explore the nonprofit sector, the sessions on social impact analysis are typically the most heavily attended. And that's where much of the foundation funding is going now, to try to get a sense of how they, as good stewards of the funds entrusted to them, are using it as well as possible. And so there is an expectation that every applicant for funding is going to have some means of demonstrating social impact analysis, which comes closer to making the kind of comparison. And, of course, these comparisons are necessary because presumably public and nonprofit organizations exist because of some kind of market failure and the failure of the price system to reflect adequately the values.
Great question. Anne had a question over here.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. And I'm sorry I didn't raise this yesterday, but it's particularly for Stephen and Juan. I'm interested in the intra-metropolitan distribution and results, and I think both of you use cities, right? Hmm. So I'm just wondering about what we would call spatial autocorrelation. And obviously, most of us observe that there are high concentrations of nonprofit arts organizations in the central cities and sometimes the inner ring suburbs, right, and a real dearth of them in areas farther out, and also that is also replicated in the pattern of location of individual artists. Mm. And I'm just wondering, in your econometrics, how did you deal, because a lot of these are next door to each other, and how did you deal with that at all, trying to account for the interrelationship, the path that the people, some of the people in the suburbs are going, patronizing the activities in these bigger central cities?
Mm. I mean, we have controls for population density, but that doesn't address the key issues with spatial autocorrelation. This is one, actually, that we were planning to address going forward, because we will be able to have access to very finely grained. The Culture 24 data is very finely grained. It's postcode level, and we should also be able to access data for creative firms at that level. So we'll be addressing it.
But England doesn't count. You haven't sprawled as much. I mean, come to America and start driving. It'll just take you days to get to. No, man, it's unsprawled. But I'm just kidding.
The greater Southeast is basically.
Yeah, well, Southeast is beginning to look like us, unfortunately. Mm. Yeah.
So in our analysis, you're exactly right. Our unit of analysis is the MSA,
right,
which is a multi-county area. So it includes the suburbs as well as the central city. It's not the, you know, city of St. Louis or the city of Cleveland. It's the St. Louis MSA. But as you know, because we were on a panel last year together, we are working using these data to analyze the clustering within the MSA, because that information is available to us from the 990. So ask me in a year.
I had a question over here. Just mix it up a bit, right in the middle there. Yeah.
Hi, I'm John Pender. I'm an economist working on rural development issues at USDA.
Just on the issue of new growth theory, my familiarity with it kind of tells me, it makes me struggle a little bit with seeing how this relates to the arts, because as I understand new growth theory, the essential aspect of it is that there's an increasing returns to scale. And so I don't quite see the mechanisms, really. I mean, if there's some kind of spillover effects, as Juan was saying, maybe that's where you get this increasing returns. But it's not obvious to me what the mechanism is of those spillovers, or that they would be geographically based. And then if you have the other kind of explanation that Juan was talking about with the sort of Richard Florida effect, attracting, you know, the amenities and attracting people, then it's not clear that you would have increasing returns in that case. So I guess, so my question is, you know, is there a way to distinguish between these different effects? And, you know, are you really seeing an increasing returns, or just something that's attracting people to communities, and maybe that's benefiting that community, but it may not be helping nearby communities? So can I add in one other question, just on related to rural areas? I wonder, is anybody looking at these issues in rural areas? And I think of places like the Blues Highway in the Mississippi Delta, for example. Right. Is there any evidence on cultural investments such as that having an economic impact?
Just one quick answer on the rural bit is about half of people who live in quote-unquote rural areas live in metropolitan areas because we've sprawled out so far.
Yeah.
So it gets to Ann's question about the intra-metropolitan kind of question for the other part of rural America that would require some additional studies. Any response on either one of those questions?
Two things. One, with the nonprofit data, we can actually look at location and development of the arts and culture production in truly non-metropolitan areas, and we've played around a little with that. One of the difficulties of trying to undertake the analysis that we've done for this is the difficulty of getting solid measures of the aggregate level of economic activity for very rural areas because of, you know, the number of establishments will be small, data suppression issues keep it from being reported at the county level. But in principle, it's doable. One thing I want to observe about the growth theory, I mean, part of what distinguishes the growth theory that lies behind our model is in distinction, you know, the older growth models of Solow and others were getting growth from assumptions about the rate of technological progress. And what we're doing is not assuming that technological progress is driving growth, but rather that capital and culture production can drive growth, and looking at accumulations in those areas. So the model is set up, and that's just, it's completely a simple adaptation of Barrow's growth endogenous growth model. So it really is about modeling capital accumulation and culture production as a way of driving growth rather than technological change.
Yeah, I would just add to that we're looking at a type of capital that doesn't get used up over time. It's still there, whether you call it cultural capital or artistic capital. It's available to everybody. One person's utilization doesn't diminish anybody else's access to it. So it has that important attribute in this context.
Maybe last question. Maybe go in the back, right back there. Just perfect.
Jonathan Katz, I direct the National Assembly of State Arts Agencies. I was intrigued by the concept of a positive shock, which I suppose could also be called an investment. And I wondered if in your research you noticed any threshold at which that shock makes a difference, or any increments in which that shock makes a difference, because we do see that in arts education, and we do see that in health benefits for arts activities. So I wondered if you see that in your economic models.
That is a great question. We haven't investigated it, but in principle, we could, you know, try to look for something about the magnitude of the shock. The data don't allow us to sort out whether the shock is from, say, an idiosyncratic change in public policy through state arts funding, or an idiosyncratic philanthropic move or gift.
But we could conceivably look for threshold effects. We just haven't investigated it.
Yeah, just to add on to that, we probably need more natural experiments to track, and we need, I guess, academically to be rewarded for case studies.
That concludes this panel. We've got about a 10-minute break. People come back. The next panel starts around 10:40, 10:45. Please thank the panelists. Excellent.
Thank you.
I would have loved to see you.
I would like to ask everybody to be seated. We can start the session. We have a fantastic panel coming up here. My name is Alan Marco. I am the Deputy Chief Economist at the Patent and Trademark Office. And we have a panel on economic growth and innovation. I'd like to switch up the timing a little bit and start off with taking my moderator's prerogative and make a couple opening remarks about economics and the economics of innovation. And as somebody, as an, really an outsider in terms of looking at the arts, I'd like to talk a little bit about how it's an exciting opportunity to be exposed to people who are doing work in economics, innovation, and the arts. So I am a bit of an outsider in this. My own research has looked at innovation from a very technical standpoint, really oftentimes looking at patents, utility patents, looking at patent litigation and firm strategy. But I am the son of a statistician and a musician. I got most of the stats. My sister got most of the music and arts, and in fact, she is she works in the arts with an organization called EMC Arts, which she tells me does work in innovation and the arts in terms of the actual management practices of arts organizations. So she was excited that I was here at the NEA. She also used to work at the NEA. So it's a good opportunity for me to see this from, in a sense, from the outside. So what I wanted to do is talk a little bit, just to set the stage for some of the papers, and tie them together a little bit in terms of talking about a couple of the big issues in economics. The previous session was a fantastic opening for that, because a lot of the issues that they were discussing are important big issues in economic growth. And as we're talking about growth and the arts in this session, I wanted to highlight a couple things. Number one, in terms of the economics of growth, there's a really big question, a really big problem in looking at this, which is what leads to economic growth? But really, the second question is almost as important, growth of what? How do we measure growth, and what are we talking about? Well, we use GDP per capita a lot as economists, we rely on this in large part because it's easy, right? We can find data on GDP per capita. It's easy. But GDP has a couple known problems. Number one, as V. Grilicus and other scholars have noted, suppose that innovation leads primarily to lower prices. If that's the case, then GDP will go down. So at the very least, GDP would understate certain kinds of growth. William Nordhaus has a famous example about this, looking at lumen output of lighting per man hour worked over time, over human history. It goes back to, I forget what year, BC, to look at this. But for most of human history, we've had less than one lumen per man hour that we can produce, or less than one lumen of lighting that we can produce with 1 hour of work. Less than one for most of human history, even to the 1800s, really to the invention of the light bulb. Since the invention of the light bulb, we're at about 10,000 lumens per man hour. So when you look at growth in that sense, right, it's a very different picture, not a very different picture, but a much more extreme picture than you get even from looking at GDP per capita. Looking at issues of quality of life, right, what does it mean to you that there is a symphony in your town, in your city? What does it mean to you that there are public museums? How do we value that? And there are ways that we can potentially value that, but they're not really put into GDP. The research in the economics of happiness has looked into some of these questions. Environmental quality is not in GDP. The value of information, unless we can see transactions on that, is not in GDP. How do you put a price on the fact that someone on the other side of the world can instantaneously and costlessly download a picture of you from 20 years ago in college wearing a pair of boxers on your head as a hat. How can you put a price on that, indeed? How do you put a price on the fact that you can walk down the street with a symphony playing in your ear and with a touch of a button answer a phone call at the same time? I can listen to Alec Baldwin reading to my children and show them Thomas the Tank Engine on my iPod. How do you put a price on that? You can put a price on the iPod, but how do you put a price on the, on that change of information? As one of our panelists has pointed out, what matters is consumer participation in some ways, not consumption. So in the networked economy, right, consumers want to have, in some sense, want to have relationships with the producers, right? Want to have relationships with producers. They want to friend them on Facebook. I can tell you right now, I'm only going to friend organizations where I have a choice, right? So I'm really not going to friend Comcast, but there might be other providers. Timberland, I might friend because I enjoy their products. It's different from me willing to put money down for a pair of shoes. So there are a lot of issues here, and some of them get to this arts and innovation, right? If I can listen to a symphony in my ear, walking down the street, to what extent does technological innovation relate to the arts and the diffusion of arts? So one of the big problems in the arts and in innovation at large is the spillover problem, right? So there are lots of spillovers, and we need – how do we solve that? So one of the big ways that we solve the spillover problem, one of the ways that we solve the spillover problem in innovation, technological innovation, is with intellectual property. I mean, it also – it's one of the tools that we use to solve that problem in the arts, in some form of the arts. So that's an element of my research, certainly. And the Patent and Trademark Office and the Economic and Statistical Administration of the Department of Commerce recently came out with a report on IP-intensive industries. And we find that employment in – and that's a very – you know, I won't talk about much about how we measure that, but employment in sort of copyright-intensive industries is just as high as employment in patent-intensive industries. So we get copyrights – patents may not be a surprise to you that the most employment comes from trademark-intensive industries because it's hard to think of a firm that you purchase something from that's not using trademarks. So these are important drivers, and not the only drivers, right? We rely on some subsidization and other things, but this big spillover problem is something that's similar between the arts and technological innovation. Within those spillovers, they tend to be localized. So the panelists today will talk in some part about this localization of these spillovers, that is subsidizing it may be important to subsidize local industries, local arts organizations, because it has a localized impact. There are, of course, broader global impacts of technology and the arts, but they do, you know, research has shown that they tend to be localized and they diffuse over time. So we'll hear more about that with localization and arts districts and so forth. Last, I just wanted to mention this complementarity between the arts and technology. So one of our panelists will talk about whether, in fact, some arts background increases your technological productivity as a researcher, right, as an engineer. And what does that mean? So exposure to arts may actually change something. It may have a causal effect. There may be a correlation there. And you only need to look at Steve Jobs as kind of an example of this. So after his death, the Patent and Trademark Office had an exhibit about all of his patents. Now, for those of you who know something about the patent system, there are design patents and there are utility patents. Utility patents are what we think of as those the technological innovations. But there are design patents as well. And we can think of designers creating design patents and inventors creating utility patents. But Steve Jobs was both, right? He had a set of design patents. He had a set of utility patents, and it got me thinking, well, what's the overlap there? And to what extent is there this kind of, you know, can we tell something about that creative side that may influence that other kind of creative side in technological innovation? And so I did a little work on this, looking at some inventor data, and I found that if you think of designers as being design patent creators and inventors being utility patent creators, and there's a subset of those who do both. Well, of all inventors, only about 5% are also designers. But of all designers, about 40% are also inventors. But more importantly, if you look at designer inventors, they're about 1.5 to 2 times more productive in terms of the number of patents that they issue, number of utility patents that they issue. So if you're a designer, 1.5 to 2 times as many utility patent grants as inventors alone. So with that, I think that that's an important thing for us to be thinking about these complementarities that may exist. And with that, I want to turn to our panel. We're going to have three panelists. Margaret Jane Wisemirsky, I practiced that. I'm not sure if I got that right. Bob Root Bernstein and Douglas Noonan. They're going to be speaking in turn. I invite Professor Wisemirsky to come up first, and then we'll have a discussion afterwards. Thank you.
Good morning. I need to start with a disclaimer. This is not an economic analysis. Okay, I'm far away enough now. Closer, okay. This is not an economic analysis. I'm really a political policy analyst. And that means that for me, I can often consider economic factors as kind of background or antecedent variables. And that's really what I've done. I've taken the sort of new growth economy as a part of the change from the industrial welfare state to the new growth competition state. When you're formulating public policy, you need to take into account both of those things as well as the policy area or content that you're taking into account. Now, I got interested in this question from a couple of different areas. One, when Mark Rushton put out a call for this conference, I looked at that and said, how do I connect this through one of the major policy frameworks that I know, which is John Kingdon's multiple streams and policy windows? There, where does the economics come into that model? And then one of my students was doing work on small arts organizations, okay, actually the smallest of the small. And we spent a lot of time trying to define what small meant in this context. And we also discovered that even though we knew that this was a large part of the local creative economies, when we looked at it in the context of Columbus and in the context of Ohio, we really were finding that what we considered micro enterprises, up to 5 employees, was basically 83% of the creative industries in the city and in the state. All right. Now, just think about that for a second in terms of where we have tended to put our focus, which is on our arts organizations that are above that size, and that's 13% of the totality. Now, of course, for economics, they're looking at the larger economic impact that middle and big range of institutions and organizations are concerned with. But we also know that the arts industry is a kind of unique industry in the way it focuses on its small, self-employed, independent workers, basically as the core of their entire sector. All right, and so that is often as 40% of a city, or it may be this more like an 80% of a city's creative context. All right, and we also then started with a third element, which is if this is the creative core of the arts sector that individual artists are, we can't get to them by policy, at least not national policy much anymore. We can still do it at the local level. We can do it at the state level, but there are difficulties in reaching individual artists in an effective way. So I wondered whether or not changing the political economic context from the industrial welfare state to the new economy competition model opens new opportunities for policy innovation concerning the issue of public support for artists. Now, in order to do this, I mentioned using Kingdon. All right, now, where does economics fit into this? He has a problem stream, which might have an economic component. He has a solution stream, which always has economic feasibility built into it. And he has a political stream. And the political stream tends to be the catalyst for change. Well, I kind of backed this up and said, okay, the political actors in the political stream actually channel changes in the economic context, economic assumptions, as part of the public mood that he talks about. So they become sort of the carriers of economic ideas and changes into this whole policy creation stream. If you also look at the new economy, you know, if you only take Romer's definition of this as taking existing activities and resources and using them in a different way, in some way that's a classic definition of an entrepreneur. Now, the business sector uses entrepreneurs as creating new ventures or new firms. All right, but there's a much broader literature that talks about entrepreneurship as kind of recombining things in interesting and different ways to create new niches or new opportunities. So if you take the broader sense of this, then we really then have a connection to entrepreneurship. All right, and finally, okay, remember the three streams of Kingdon. There's a supposed connection between the way the problem is defined and the kinds of solutions that you start looking at. All right, so you're going to hear from a lot of other speakers at this conference. You've heard from some of them already that there are linkages in this issue definition stream that says when we look at the arts, sometimes we look at them in the context of creative and cultural industry. Sometimes we look at them in terms of city economic development and creative cities. Sometimes we use it as a factor in small business development. It's a factor in the competition state at the local, internal level, where the competition state model is typically used internationally. It's involved in career development for artists. It's a part of arts entrepreneurship, and, of course, it is part of the creative class. And as you've also seen so far, many of our speakers are not going to be really talking about individual artists as their unit of analysis. They're either combining the whole sector or they're primarily looking at arts organizations. So this sort of addresses a sort of gap in a lot of the other approaches. But if you look at just this, okay, your key words are, all right, there are a number of ways in which we're already defining individual artists or arts-based entrepreneurs as part of the city new growth model. It's a matter of artists and supporting creativity. It's a matter of local consumption and city development. It's a matter of small business development and urban affairs. It's a matter of the creative class. So that's at least four different ways in which the issue can be framed. And I would argue that by solving the first one or paying attention to the first one about the arts and supporting artists as a way of supporting creativity, you have the option of creating a policy solution that is arts policy connects to city development policy, connects to labor policy. And therefore, we have a solution that might hit on three different political bases. Now, I'm not going to speak through these at great length. I just put them there to kind of give you some sense of how our thinking might change if we said, okay, how did we think about things in the industrial welfare state? And how does that translate into how we thought about the arts at the same period? All right, and what, you know, here you can see many of the things that we've already seen sort of begin to happen. As we just transferred the industrial welfare state to the patron state. All right, this one takes the new economy assumptions and tries to translate them into cultural policy assumptions. All right, notice here that one of the first elements is entrepreneurial as opposed to a decentralized style. All right. And again, I think that is the nature of the new economy. It already directs us towards an entrepreneurial set of options. But you'll also see that the rise of the creative class fits here. The emphasis on localism and creative cities fits here. The creative industries perspective fits here. And we'll come back to the issue of the emphasis on public value fits here. Now, one other comparison I want you to keep in mind. And that's under the old industrial welfare state. The way we thought about policy concerning arts organizations was in many ways significantly different than how we thought about artists. All right, and there are two things I want you to take out of this. One is that as a matter of industrial welfare policy, we thought of the development of arts organizations largely as a matter of both managerial excellence and managerial competence and artistic excellence, two dimensions of quality. All right, when we looked at the paradigm for individual artists, we see only one of those dimensions. There is no mention of defining or developing managerial competence. All right, it's all on artistic development. All right, professionalism is largely developed as artistic competence. And there's also a great emphasis on the organizational model for developing relationships between the organizations and their markets and audiences. There is no such emphasis when you talk about individual artists. So we have to say we're dealing with two different models at the industrial welfare state, which means we probably also should expect two different models when we move into the new competition state. One last sort of piece of, well, two more pieces of models, okay, because I'm putting together lots of different models in this context of Kingdon to try to figure out really what I am looking for as the markers or the hallmarks of potential policy options. All right, so in Investing in Creativity, a study done in 2003 by a consortium of foundations about how to respond to the inability to fund artists nationally as a matter of fellowships, all right, they looked at sort of, well, what do artists need actually to prosper? And we can see that in the old industrial welfare state, we tended to focus on the first three attributes: validation, markets, and material supports, which often meant space or money. What we didn't spend as much time on was training and professional development, or professional development was limited really to artistic professional development, communities and network building, and information. In many ways, you can say this is the infrastructure part of supporting artists. So that gives me another element that says, well, maybe that's something we need to address in the new economy. And finally, there's some interesting work done by Tremblay in Canada where she's talked about sort of creative risk. And we know that risk is a factor across the creative sector. It's one of the unifying factors between the commercial sector, the nonprofit sector, the informal sector. Well, she says that art is really about three kinds of risk: the uncertainty of creation, the uncertainty of consumption, both of which we're familiar with. You know, the difficulty of knowing whether an artwork will find an audience, whether it'll find an audience in the lifetime of that artist, whether the work will get professional acceptance. But she adds in also career risk. And since we know that artists often move from different parts of the sector to other parts of the sector, that they often put together careers and employment by piecing together projects or moving from different kinds of organizations, career management, okay, if you want to be entrepreneurs of your own career, tend to be one of the factors that we don't quite look at or focus on in terms of policy. So I put all these things together. And I started to say, all right, I'm first directed towards entrepreneurship. Well, there is a set of entrepreneurs in the arts that exist. So instead of doing a mathematical experiment, I'm sort of searching the field for prototypes, models that might sort of address this question and see how they're working when they're being adopted. All right, now, an artisan is a person who has a skill in the applied arts, such as a craftsman, high quality, distinctive products, small quantities, and often sort of handmade or traditionally made. More recently, we've taken some of the traditional pieces out of it, kept the small production scale, the sort of flexible informal organization which characterizes these micro-enterprises, professional skills and idea. Professional is really in the making and in the skills, not necessarily in sort of certain kinds of acclimation or validation. All right, and then you put this together with entrepreneur. All right, and so this is finding new and innovative ways to take advantage of opportunity without the assurance of success, and this is the risk factor. So we basically said, let's call these arts-based entrepreneurs. Now, we thought of thinking of them as artisans, but that runs into problems when you talk about the arts. Because an artisan in most other areas of the economy really is somebody who takes a mass-produced product, sort of customizes it, boutiques it, okay? So you have artisan bread, and you have artisan coffee, and you have artisan food, all right? So that by taking the small scale and the value added of creativity to it, you're trying to actually increase the status of the good. In the arts, you start with something that has a high value added element of creativity. What you're trying to do is assist the business reach and market reach of those kinds of activities. So we decided artisan carried too much baggage. We went back to arts entrepreneur. Now, not all arts entrepreneurs are the same thing, all right? And a number of times you read that on the one hand, the arts require great nuance. But on the other hand, we tend to try to cluster arts information as broadly as possible so we can get a large data set, all right? My starting assumption is that that hides an awful lot of differences and that this we're going to need a much more nuanced set of policy options. So I'm going to focus on the first two kinds of entrepreneurs, creative entrepreneurs and cultural entrepreneurs. Okay, they're both art-based. Creative entrepreneurs are based on creative innovation. They're the creating current artists. All right, cultural entrepreneurs are people who tend to base their creative assets are cultural, their heritage assets. So that when we say craftsmen, we're often talking about folk arts. We're talking about handmade art and crafts. That's where cultural entrepreneurs happen. All right, and if you look at the sort of range of things in the atmosphere, we're seeing that foundations are trying to address this, often through local projects. You've got cultural entrepreneurs showing up all over the place that have gotten public support but haven't quite sort of reached a critical mass. If you look at micro entrepreneurs, they're not even the same kind. And I want to end with a couple of major questions, okay, and I'll be wrapping up right there. Okay, first, there's a structural option. There's a structural problem. Typically, we can only reach policy to nonprofit organizations or state entities. Individuals don't fit that. How do we get around the literally formal organizational problem? Second, capacity building. This is capacity that really needs to be built organizationally, as though you were treating them as a microorganization. And third, there is the question of moving them into the digital networked environment. We're using social media for a lot of management processes like fundraising, like marketing is going to come through digital techniques for them. And lastly, and perhaps one of the biggest questions, is how do you get the arts policy community to feel comfortable with this idea? A lot of artists will simply not consider themselves entrepreneurs, nor want to be entrepreneurial. And yet, if you actually look at a lot of what they're doing and what's working, they're in fact acting as entrepreneurs. So I would sort of suggest that this is sort of one of the primary places to look for a policy option in the new economy for supporting the core of creative activity. And then there's a lot of development that still has to go into that in terms of feasibility on a number of different scales to see whether it'll match. Thank you.
Good morning. Many thanks to the organizers for inviting me here today, and I also want to thank my research collaborators at Michigan State University, Rex Lamore and John Schweitzer of the Center for Community Economic Development, Eileen Warbach, James Lawton, Michelle Root Bernstein of the College of Arts and Letters, and Amber Peruski and Megan Van Dyke of the MSU Honors College, who are here in the audience today. In the rise of the creative class, Richard Florida suggests that high-tech innovators and artists tend to congregate in the same geographical locales. Why would such a relationship exist? We propose that arts-rich communities and high-tech entrepreneurial activity may coexist in part because the science, technology, engineering, and mathematically trained individuals, or what I'm going to call STEM professionals, who found high-tech companies also participate in the arts, And they do so because they perceive arts and crafts to be valuable contributors to their personal and professional creative capacity. An important variable that we explore that's often left out of economic models is the effect of both formal and informal arts and crafts education on this relationship. The hypothesis that entrepreneurial innovators, by which we mean individuals who successfully bring an invention to market, are highly likely to be personally engaged in arts and crafts originated from studies of eminent scientists. A variety of studies dating back as far as 1878 demonstrates that participation in arts and crafts strongly correlates with scientific success. For example, Nobel Prize winners have about three times as many adult avocations as the average scientist, represented here by the Sigma Xi data, or a typical member of the American public as determined by NEA surveys. The Nobel laureates are between 15 and 25 times as likely as the average scientist to engage as an adult in fine arts such as painting, sculpting, printmaking, crafts such as woodworking and metalworking, performance arts such as acting and dancing, and creative writing or poetry. In addition to these statistical correlations, I have documented in many of my publications the ways in which eminent scientists benefit from their avocations through skill development, knowledge, concepts, methods, and a simple understanding of the creative process itself. These studies provide the impetus to investigate whether a similar link exists between arts and crafts participation and economic measures of entrepreneurial innovation, such as patent production, copyrights, and the founding of new companies, among other groups of STEM professionals. In the first place, we gathered data on the reported lifetime participation in various arts and crafts explored by Michigan State University Honors College graduates who had majored in a STEM subject between 1990 and 1995 and went into a STEM field. We compared these with the data on the lifetime participation of U.S. public as determined by a 2008 National Endowment for the Arts survey. Participation by the MSU Honors STEM graduates is statistically significantly higher than the public in every category, lending credence to the hypothesis that STEM innovators may be attracted to and even to help build arts-rich communities because of their personal proclivities, their values, and their experiences. We've also surveyed the members of the National Academy of Engineering, the NAE, who have arts and crafts participation profiles similar, though certainly not identical, to those of Nobel Prize winners and the MSU Honors College STEM graduates. NAE members are much more likely than the average American to participate as an adult in photography, to have crafts avocations such as woodworking and metalworking, glassblowing and mechanics, to draw and to paint, and to play music. Notably, a random sampling of university engineering faculty have virtually identical avocational profiles as the NAE members, and these data again suggest an unusual degree of participation by engineers in a variety of arts and crafts. We've also found that there's a strong correlation between lifetime arts and crafts participation and those scientists and engineers who produce the most intellectual property in the form of patents, copyrights, and new companies founded. National Academy of Engineering respondents were divided into those with five or less patents and those with more than five patents. Statistically significant positive correlations with patent production were found for sustained participation from childhood through mature adulthood in photography, music, which included playing an instrument, composing, or singing, crafts, electronics, computing, and writing, both creative and nonfiction. Negative correlations were found for fabric arts and performing arts, such as dancing, acting, and theater. These were practiced mainly by women in the members of the NAE, who had also the least production of intellectual property. We're not entirely sure why. But within that group itself, however, the practice of fabric arts and performing arts is not counterproductive to the public production of intellectual property. We also compared the sustained avocations of Michigan engineering faculty, some of whom had found, or none of whom had founded a company, with awardees of the highly competitive Michigan Economic Development Corporation fundees, who are explicitly awarded the money to found new companies. Positive significant differences correlate sustained participation in fine arts, such as drawing, painting, and printmaking, the crafts, woodworking, metalworking, mechanics, and glass again, and performing arts, such as dancing, acting, and theater, with founding new high-tech companies. Finally, sustained arts and crafts participation by MSU honors STEM graduates also correlates well with the production of intellectual property, such as patents, copyrights, and companies. While there's a general trend towards participation in all arts and crafts, save for music, being higher among those who produce patents and found new companies than among those who do not, and at every stage of life, sustained participation from childhood through mature adulthood in five arts and crafts shown here were highly significant: photography, woodwork, mechanics, electronics, and dancing. Inventors and innovators tend to be people who work with their hands and their bodies, as well as their minds, over a lifetime. Now, correlation, of course, is not causation. So to move beyond mere statistics, we also asked all of the groups who we looked at, this was a total of 225 individuals, does your avocation or hobby, or the skills, knowledge, aesthetic, social contacts, creative practices, or just plain perseverance that you gain from it, play any role in your current vocation? As this figure shows, an average of about 65% of the members of every group stated that there were direct links between their vocation and their avocation. Typical responses included the following. I use some of my skills from drawing to create stimuli for experiments. Experience with visual composition helps to create good diagrams and presentations. Quilting is a great way of using creativity and analytical thinking to solve problems and create something that is aesthetically appealing. It improves my creativity in my current vocation. Mechanical and material properties I learned in my hobbies can often relate to mechanical and material issues in microelectronics, especially in my specific discipline. Paper folding and wood blocks gave me early insight into 3D geometry, which is critical to my work. All of these groups were also asked, would you recommend arts and crafts education as a useful or even essential background for a scientific innovator? Surprisingly, 80% of the members of every surveyed group responded yes. Again, typical responses provide some insight into why. Yes, ability to make simple prototypes and models with my own hands is vital for creativity in product design. Mechanical skills are important for constructing experimental apparatus. Pattern visualization is very important and is developed by my arts and crafts. Yes, I think moving around, dancing, playing on the playground helps one get a visceral feeling for physics. Or simply, yes, it improves creativity. In short, these scientists and engineers report the same types of connections between their arts and crafts training and their professional ability that Nobel laureates, who I've studied previously, reported. The high regard successful STEM professionals have for their arts is validated by formal controlled studies demonstrating that one of the best correlates of success in any STEM subject is visual thinking ability. The simple intervention of a drawing or painting class can dramatically improve success of underperforming students in STEM subjects, and so some of the connections between arts and crafts STEM ability, which are asserted on the basis of personal experience and observation by our interviewees and surveyed individuals, have a basis in formal scientific studies. We've also employed both our statistical study and free response questions to investigate whether there are particular arts or crafts experiences at particular times during a scientist's or engineer's life that are especially important for developing particular skills, knowledge, or processes appropriate to stimulating STEM innovation and entrepreneurship. We have thus far failed to identify any specific indicators. Only four findings regarding arts and crafts experiences have thus far withstood our repeated inspection of the data. One is that formal arts education is no more important than private lessons, informal mentoring, or self-learning. Another is that arts and crafts, that require significant innovative practice correlated with entrepreneurial outcomes better than ones that tend to involve mainly following instructions. So, for example, composing music rather than simply playing an instrument. Third, while mature avocations are a good correlate for innovation and entrepreneurship, even better one is the practice of one or more arts and crafts sustained from childhood through mature adulthood. Transient or late exposure to arts and crafts does not appear to be nearly as effective as long-term mastery. Our fourth finding is that the probability of pursuing an avocation as an adult, which is our best correlate of innovativeness, is dependent to a very strong degree on being introduced to that avocation as a child. This figure compares the rates at which two groups of adult STEM professionals participate in various arts and crafts. One group, the tall bars, were introduced to that avocation as a child. The other group, the short bars, took up their avocation for the first time as an adult. Clearly, the probability that a STEM professional will have one or more arts and crafts avocation is highly dependent on having consistent access to arts and crafts training materials and institutions throughout their lives. Since adult and sustained participation in arts and crafts are the best correlates of STEM innovation and entrepreneurship, early introduction, sustained ability, and adult participation are critically important. We draw a number of tentative conclusions from our studies thus far. The most important is that the connections between arts and entrepreneurial innovation are a complex system of interactions that cannot be modeled using any simple cause and effect methodology. Included in this web of interactions are arts, crafts, formal education systems, informal education systems, private and individual mentors, cultural institutions, established businesses, entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, the intellectual property that they invent and invest in, and the new companies that are founded. The system is centered on and mediated by individual STEM professionals and the interests and values that they develop doing their work and then bring to their communities. Now, there's no doubt from our results that the arts and crafts knowledge, whether acquired through formal or informal education, means is very important to STEM innovators, and the persistent experience with arts and crafts correlates strongly with economically important measures of entrepreneurship. Arts and crafts are therefore valuable to the development and training of STEM innovators. Our results suggest equally that because STEM innovators highly value arts and crafts, the system of interactions is going to be forward and backward. What this perhaps is most important for this system is that the STEM businesses within an emerging knowledge economy have reciprocal interactions in the places at which they are located. The arts experience that a child has in school or at home in a cultural institution determine to a large extent that whether that child will become and stay involved with the art or craft long enough to actually master the lessons and apply it to their STEM entrepreneurship. STEM professionals, in short, can mediate both arts and high-tech development in the same communities because they are both scientists and artists themselves all at one time. We therefore propose that STEM professionals not only draw upon the arts, pun intended, to develop their developmental entrepreneurial innovations, but also that they repay this debt by reinvesting in the arts and crafts institutions and educational systems in a robust degree. Thank you very much.
All right, good morning. I'm Doug Noonan. This is going to be reporting on some research I've done with a colleague of mine at Georgia Tech, Sherry Bresnitz. We're going to be looking at arts districts, the role of universities and media arts, and the main questions we're looking at here is trying to identify the impacts of cultural districts and major research universities on economic growth locally in terms of jobs and innovation in particular, and in particular in the media arts sector. So the sort of more narrow questions we want to answer with this research is looking at how media arts employment and innovation differs from overall employment and innovation in a city, whether that city has or does not have an arts or cultural district, or whether or not that city has a number of major research universities or not. And we also want to look at the trends in employment and the trends in innovation in media arts, and whether those differ, or how they differ between cities with and without arts districts and with and without research universities. And then we're also kind of interested in the interaction effect, or the combination of having both universities and arts districts, and whether you get something where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts in terms of media arts employment and innovation. And the bottom line we'll end up seeing here is that arts districts have consistently stronger and positive impacts on arts and media arts-related innovation, whereas universities seem to be promoting arts and media arts-related employment, which ties nicely into the talk we just saw. And interestingly, for the university's effect, it seems to be occurring in the broader urban area rather than in the city of the universities itself. The background on a lot of this research doesn't need to go in. I don't need to go into much detail on it. It's building off of stuff we've already talked about this morning, where there's a lot of work that's been done already on sort of direct income and direct impacts of local arts institutions and artists themselves on the region's exporting base, or on the ability to draw in outside funding and visitors bringing cash and economic activity into a region. And then more recently, we've been seeing sort of this creative class style arguments, where we see some more indirect effects of arts and arts industries on bringing high level human capital and certain types of high tech firms and other likes into a region's economy, and sort of diversifying and altering the composition of that local economic base. And I want to try to marry that literature with another bit of research that's quite separate from a lot of the work on arts policy and cultural economics, and that's looking at universities as drivers of local innovation and the spillovers that come out of major research universities on local economies. And it's been established that universities are very important sources of new knowledge and technology, and a lot of that emphasis goes into tech transfer and how we measure the output of universities and the contributions in terms of commercializing new technologies coming out of universities. And increasingly, universities are under some pressure to be making contributions to societies, and often that, and especially their local economic regions, and more that's seen as through research and development activities, in particular through tech transfer with industry. But I think we're underappreciating a lot of the services and activities going on at universities that aren't as easily quantified as some of that tech transfer, and raises some interesting questions about sort of other public service roles of universities and their impact on local economies. And some of this, you know, the creative class style argument picks up, and that universities are more than just about technology generation. They're also doing a lot with generating talent or attracting talent and doing stuff with tolerance that we've seen in the earlier talks. So what I want to try to do is bring in sort of the arts contributions, the potential arts contributions of major research universities, and see how they're going to affect our understanding of arts in a local economic growth setting. And I want to focus on the media arts as an interesting intersection between the high tech and the artistic creation, sort of bringing in that creative class style vocations and industries along with more conventional university activities, where something that has fairly important links straight back to universities as well, and university education and research, as well as to something like arts districts. And I'm not just looking at media arts in this work. We're also looking at more traditional arts related occupations and industries, partly just for contrast purposes. So what do I mean by media arts? Here we're looking at artistic and creative content in new and especially digital formats and forms, digital art, computerized animation, interactive art, internet art. And we're going to classify a lot of these arts by looking at different very inclusive definitions for occupation and industry codes and patent classifications. There's a lot of emerging industries industries thought to be growing quite rapidly that overlap with this media arts notion. We want to see, is this being driven at all by arts districts or universities? The data we use for all of this, our unit of observation, we're going to be looking at city-level data here. We take the 100 most populous cities in the U.S., and we're going to see based on an old list of cities that had about 89 cities that had arts or cultural districts inside them, there's a number of cities on this list that weren't in the top 100 most populous cities, so we add those cities in as well. We're left with about 150 cities. Roughly half of these things have an arts or cultural district. And then we're also going to look at the presence of research-extensive R1 universities in those cities, so the number of R1s in the city, and also in the core-based statistical area, so a little bit broader notion of the metropolitan area, also including some smaller towns. And then we're going to match into this data set off patent data, where we're matching the patent assignee, the inventor, to the city that they list as their residence. And throughout a lot of this, the notion of innovations I'm using essentially synonymously with patenting activity, which is sort of obviously a very limited notion of what we mean by innovation. But it does have an advantage in that it ties pretty directly back to the more broader literature on innovation and university-led innovation, which heavily focuses on patents and patent data. And then my employment data is coming from the current population survey, which we're matching to the metro area of the respondent, looking at their first or second jobs as available. All right. So the method we use here, it's basically OLS regression approach, where we're going to think about whether you have an arts district or not, or whether you've got a number of R1 universities as the treatment. So we just think about treatment and effect. What's the effect of having this sort of treatment? And then we're looking at the effect on employment and innovation. We're looking at both of these notions as shares of overall employment or shares of overall innovation. So we're essentially implicitly going to be controlling for overall shocks to the size of the local economy. If employment as a whole goes up or down, we're not that interested in it. What we're interested in is the sort of arts intensity or media arts intensity of that employment going up or down. Is the rate of patenting in media arts relative to rates of patenting more generally going up or down? And we're going to look at whether or not those shares are higher or lower in cities with or without this treatment. We're also going to look at the trends. So we want to see, are the trends in these shares going up or down differentially based on whether or not you've got research universities or arts districts? And the nice part about this is it's going to help us at least in a sense, control for the possibility that there might be something special in the first place about these cities that have arts districts or major research universities. And by looking at trends, if there's sort of this chicken and egg problem, then it's not arts-intensive employment that's a result of the arts district, but because you've got a lot of artists in town, that's why you got the arts district. After the fact, we're going to be looking at trends following the establishment of these arts districts or establishment of these universities and see if the paths are diverge in any way. And one thing we did find in looking through all of this, and that if you go back to, say, 1990 data, cities that have high-intensity concentration in arts or media arts employment don't seem to be any more or less likely to have an arts district in them come the year 2000. Districts don't seem to be drawn to arts-intensive cities, at least according to that list. So the results we get is sort of a collage of results, a lot of different statistical models that have been estimated. I'm going to go through some of the results, and these results show up in four main ways. We're looking at employment shares circa 2006, where we're looking at four different measures of employment, two for arts-related employment, two for media arts-related employment, one's employment in arts occupations, and one's employment in arts-related industries, and the same for media arts. Then we're looking at those same things, not just the level of employment in 2006, but the trends from 99 to 2011. Then we have a pair of results, one looking at patenting, and then the trends in patenting as well. Patenting data only goes up to 2006. And we're looking at the total number of patents, and I'm more interested in the share of overall patents that are going to media arts. So results that we find, arts districts seem to be leading to an increase or higher levels of arts and media arts employment. The baseline here, we're looking at about 2.5% of the employment base in arts or media arts employment, and we're looking at an increase of about 0.5%, so up to about 3%. So a small effect, but off a small base, it's actually relatively large. Having more R1 universities in the city doesn't have any impact on employment, but if we look at the more broad notion, more broader definition in the urban area, we see that more R1s in the urban area does lead to a significant increase in arts and media arts-related employment. And interesting, when we switch to looking at this in terms of trends, the effect of arts districts on the trends in arts employment disappears. And there isn't a stable effect of arts districts on increasing intensity of arts employment. within the city, whereas the R1s, the number of universities there, has a persistent effect and an increasing trend. So we see a modest impact off a base of about a 1% growth over the last decade in arts or media arts-related employment, about a tenth of a percent increase for every R1 you have in your CBSA. And the, as far as an interaction effect, is the whole greater than the sum of the parts? And we see there's no evidence of this. These things, there's no positive or negative interaction effect going on there. With respect to more the innovation or patenting side of things, having more arts districts shows it up as an increasing rate of media arts patenting in 2006. But the average city patenting rate for media arts is roughly double that if you have an arts district in town. Having more R1s in town had no impact on the share of media arts patenting. Now, having more R1s in town led to more patenting in the city overall, but not a differential impact on the share of those patents that are going to media arts. And if you look at just raw counts of patents, each additional R1 in the city is associated with about 5 additional media arts patents per year. Having an arts district in town, another additional 5 patents in media arts-related fields per year. Having both of them is an additional on top of both that 10, plus 10 there. Having both of them would get you another 4. So there does seem to be an interaction effect there with respect to innovation. Having both of those things does better in terms of the raw counts of patents. But if we look at this in terms of trends, not just that level of total amount of patenting, but the rate of increase of media arts patenting as a whole composition of patents, the increasing rates of media arts patenting as a share of all overall patenting is actually a steeper trajectory in cities that have arts and cultural districts in them. In fact, the growth rate in media arts patenting is 3 times larger in cities that have arts districts than those that don't. The count of R1 universities in that town, whether it's in the broader metro area or in the city itself, seems to have no impact on the change in the trends in share of patenting going on, and there's no interaction effect going on in the trends side of the story. So the main conclusions for all this, R1 universities in the urban areas seem to lead to an increase in media arts employment, shares, and trends. Having more R1s in the same city has no impact on media arts employment. Having an arts district in town seems to lead to an increase in media arts employment between 1999 and 2006. But if we look at a broader time span, say from 1990 to 2010 or 2011, then that effect off arts districts on employment disappears. And it's a very transitory effect that I wouldn't say is stable in the data. So on the innovation side of things, it's a little bit simpler story. Cultural districts are associated with much higher media arts patenting, both in shares in 2006 as well as trends leading up to then, when R1 universities don't seem to have a differential impact. Presence of these things doesn't seem to affect the media arts patenting rates in any given city. So sort of our bottom lines here ends up being a little bit unintuitive in that our sort of naive expectations going into this, especially if we believe a lot of the hype we read, it's arts districts are going to be great for local employment and help boost local employment in arts-related fields, and universities are good for innovation, so they're going to help lead to more patenting. And what we end up finding is almost the opposite of this, in that cultural districts are the ones that seem to be promoting innovation, at least in media arts-related fields. It's consistent with a clustering of sort of creative entrepreneurial types in media arts around or in cities that have arts and cultural districts. And these things don't – cultural districts don't seem to be the location for arts or media arts-related employment intensity. Whereas R1s, more research-intensive universities, seem to be promoting the arts and media arts-related employment. They are the ones who are attracting and training labor for nearby arts districts, whether they're actually – sort of STEM researchers or artists themselves, I am not distinguishing, but it's consistent with the story that R1 universities are more attracting and creating the labor supply in the arts rather than actually the innovation and the patenting for it. They are doing that, but not anything more or less than patenting in other fields. So I think there's some interesting puzzles that come out of this. We've got a lot more work to do, whether we're going to be looking at some more case studies on this and getting to know some of the sort of top and bottom performing cities. We want to break down and look into cities. There's a lot of within city variation, and these districts can be quite small. So what's going on within a city around these districts to get more localized effects? And then we want to also be looking at what are the universities themselves actually doing in terms of producing this labor supply, or are they just attracting it? What's the effect of different arts programs or arts departments at universities in terms of creating this kind of talent? But that's all future work. We're stuck with what we have right now. Thank you.
difficult to allow the technically proficient people to actually put on a microphone. So I used up some of my comments, some time for comments up front, so I didn't want to move to questioning very quickly, especially from the audience, but I did want to quickly just lead off with one question to the panel, and then as the microphones come around, I want to get to the audience very quickly. So for the panel, there's been a lot of emphasis with the creation of the digital economy, right? This has really been incredible for the individual access to works of art, to music, to whatever, across the country, across the globe. It's a technological change that's changed access to the arts amongst, you know, along with other types of information. At the same time, there's been an emphasis on localization across a lot of different areas of the economy, including local foods, but also with local arts performances and so forth. So I wanted to ask a general question for the panel. To what extent do you see these as, in some sense, in competition with one another versus being complementary, right? So there's these kinds of tensions. And I know that Margaret, in your work in looking at that, you know, you emphasize the use of kind of social networking, right, in terms of helping entrepreneurs. But to what extent, in some sense, is this access to these networks diminishing the demand for some of these local this localization effect? So I want to kind of a general, you know, anyone on the panel wants to respond to that, and then we can get to some questions from the audience.
Well, I'll sort of take a little bit of that with people operating at the very small micro enterprise level in the arts tend to really replace a lot of what might be organizational marketing, fundraising, by using social networks. And in terms of fundraising, that often allows them access to a broader network than local. But in terms of marketing, it tends to allow them to reach local audiences much more cheaply because they really rely on word of mouth through social network for that. And that will go to Kickstarter or other kinds of crowdsourcing for the fundraising. So I think it may vary depending on what kind of function you're using the social network and the network and technology to sort of do.
Yeah, I think one of the problems we have to think about is consumerism versus actively participating, and what the difference is in terms of skills, knowledge, and so forth that you generate. Certainly, my wife and I, for example, just went to a concert in Lansing, and there were only two people in the audience younger than we were. That's really frightening because that means that basically, although people may be able to listen on their iPod or whatever it happens to be to great classical music played by the best people, the number of venues for performers now becomes very small. The number of people attending those venues becomes very small. And certainly when we're looking at students and their access to being able to play an instrument, they may hear this, they may be able to get it very cheaply from iTunes, but do they actually translate that into active participation in any way? And then do they invest their money later on in the cultural institutions? You could have a great symphony, but if your young people don't know what classical music is, don't care about classical music, have never played an instrument, can they understand or participate in it?
Right, and it's then, a big difference,
course,
as you point out.
There's the whole issue that we're looking at. If they don't develop those skills, then right. We have no way to transfer them into right. to other fields and get the innovations at all.
Right, right.
Yeah, I think these are all really big and important interests for the field as a whole, and how much of the sort of arts consumption needs to be in a specific place, and how much of a substitution, sort of how much of a loss is it to listen to the concert as you're walking down the street versus actually being at the venue and seeing live performance. I think that's it's an increasing challenge and an important one in the field. But I also think that's on the consumption side, and the production side is also very interesting, where how much do you actually need to be there in some place to be able to produce the arts? or to produce the culture instead of just putting it up as a YouTube video and letting it go. And the substitutability of place in the production process is a big one. And if there is a role for being at the place to be able to produce, you have to show up to the office or wherever, then I think what we see are these kinds of localization effects are still going to be very strong because you want to have a somewhat thicker labor market so that you have other options for potential employers or potential ways to make money if you're in one of these sort of clusters in a bigger city. And so you'll see that, I think, in the long run in a lot of fields, but it might be shrinking.
Right, right. And so it's a good distinction between the production and the consumption side because you know, as you've shown, there's a difference between these people being involved actually in the arts versus just sort of as a observer.
Yeah, we're also a little bit worried about the geography and timing of all this. I mean, if you think about our data, we're looking at people, surveying them, say, 30 years after they were introduced and, say, played their instrument, made their art and so forth, or got their education, whether formal or informal. So they could have gotten it in a little town in Idaho.
Right.
And now be working in Silicon Valley.
Right.
The Idaho could have been the critical factor for them, and I'm not sure how we actually picked that up economically or any other way.
Right.
Another complication.
Right. I think there were some questions. Let's go over here first. And then.
Hi. This is just a general point. I fully agree with your earlier statement that GDP per capita is not a measure of happiness, and it shouldn't be, but I'd like to defend GDP per capita a little bit. You said that we don't measure the value of prices going down. That's in the real price index, and generally people do look at that when they're comparing countries across time. Because, of course, prices are higher than 1929, but also, even adjusting for price, GDP per capita is higher.
Thank you. No, there are different ways of...
Hi, I'm Rachel Soloveitchik from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, which is why...
There's certainly ways that we can get that in there. And I will say that money won't buy happiness, but it doesn't hurt either. So, you know, I'm happy to say that. We had a question right here.
Hi, Pamela Jennings from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. I had a question about the R1 research. Very interesting statistics you have there. But I was wondering whether you're looking at also the politics of access to the ability of certain disciplines and departments to actually get the resources, the mentoring, to be able to actually push their inventions forward for patents at research universities. And whether or not you're also looking at the phenomenon, particularly in the media arts, digital media arts, of people who are actually starting to go into disciplines and align themselves with disciplines where they can get the resources that they need to do their work.
Yeah, I think that's a great issue. A good at least comment. I'm not sure if I can answer the question part of that. And that we haven't broken down stuff too much yet. And one of the things we're going to do is look at the composition of those R1s and the presence of those programs. And it'll be crude at best, but it'll be better than what we've done so far, and it'll be a start to see how much is it the presence of these sort of more obviously arts-related programs driving this versus people who are actually going outside of the arts and getting their computer science degree in order to later go and help make some video game content. It's fundamentally very creative and artistic.
So, yeah, just to quickly follow up on that, I guess my question is toward whether or not, when you're also looking at the structures within the research universities, if they're open to actually talking with people from the arts programs in terms of giving them the resources needed to push their patents or their innovations forward.
Yeah, we're not looking at that. I'm not sure that there's a great deal of variance across R1s or cities or universities. There might be very little of that communication going on and might be fairly homogenous. Where I come from a tech school that if it had an arts program, we would make it an official policy to not speak to them, I think. Certainly we wouldn't share resources.
Hi, my name is Joan Jeffrey. I'm the director of the Research Center for Arts and Culture at the National Center for Creative Aging. Professor Ruth Bernstein, my question is for you. Some very, very interesting work, and I'm wondering if you've noticed, it went by so fast, I hope this is correct, but that it looks like some of the participation by the STEM people are in greater in art forms that people can do alone. The visual arts with their hands, things like this. You even made the distinction about something the field has been debating for a long time, creative versus interpretive arts, by saying following instructions, playing an instrument. Of course, we all know there's more to playing an instrument than following instructions. And I wonder if you will have the ability to go into your data more deeply to look at that and to look at the kinds of skills that might be translatable specifically into entrepreneurism and for communities.
Yeah, we had not actually broken it down that way, but I can tell you that we have been looking at each of the groups and breaking them down by, for example, whether they are producing companies and what kind of arts they're engaged in. This is sort of off the top of my head remembering, and we have two of the researchers here so they can wave their hands and tell me I'm totally wrong. But my recollection is that in the founding companies, we are often talking about high rates of things like dancing, acting, theater arts, those kinds of things. Writing skills are extremely important. So those are sort of popping up. And if you think about those are communication to groups or working with group kinds of things. And that would make sense if you're going, I'm just thinking of one of my colleagues from when I was an undergraduate. He was the director of the university acting program, and the first thing he did out of college was to go found a company. To get everybody to work together and all the actors and the lighting people and everything, you know, in a theater production obviously requires many of the same skills it's going to take to put together a company and make it actually work and do it under budget and all those kinds of things. And I think you're probably right that many of these people are working, the actual inventors who are getting a license, patent, for example, are probably working alone, despite the fact that we have a lot of rhetoric about, you know, group creativity and so forth and so on. A lot of the ideas are still coming from individuals. They then have to sell it to somebody. They have to work with groups. But the initiation of those is often by themselves, and they need those individual skills. So that'll be something very interesting to look into.
I wonder if you're able on that also to look at the groups of inventors on those on specific patents and to see whether they're more likely to actually work with more collaborators.
We don't have that data. But do you have any way to look at
it? It's not with the patent data.
Yeah, we have patent data.
It may surprise you that we do, but we can't distinguish one inventor from another, though. Yeah. John Smith in New York? Don't know.
Interesting.
Okay, so one last question right over here.
Jack Walsh from the National Alliance for Media Arts and Culture. And actually, I have two questions. One's for Margaret and then one for Douglas. So, Margaret, I was very intrigued when you cited Creative Capital and Center for Cultural Innovation as being in the forefront of supporting artists, which, of course, they are. But it's important to recognize that their support is not just with professional skills, but they actually give dollars and grants for artists to create work. I think that's something that often gets missed when we talk about the economic sustainability of the field, is that artists really need dollars as well as these professional skills. And Douglas, I just wanted to raise the question to you, because you're basing all the results of creativity, if I understand it correctly, on patents, which is great, but there's also research that my organization's done that looks at actual hours of work, original work created over a year in a lot of community-based centers. I think is also an important thing for you to be looking at, because it's copyrighted work, but it's over 335,000 hours of original programming. So I think that should also come in when you're looking at the media arts to like what success can be tracked as, because patents is a very limited look at what media arts is doing right now.
Absolutely, I agree, and I'd love to get a hold of those kinds of measures. It'd be great.
Well, and speaking of cultural capital, yes, they support the project, the person, the sort of infrastructure underneath it, and sort of market reach. And so what I think that really does is sort of tell us that the pipeline between entrepreneurship, creation, entrepreneurship, and innovation, which is then reaching the market, is really a multi-phase process. And if we're not supporting all elements of it or finding a way to work that into the ecology, then we're not going to have the kind of impacts that we're hoping for.
And I think that kind of is true across all levels of innovation, right? Mm-hmm. That you have initial ideas development and commercialization across that path.
Mm-hmm. And in science and tech, for instance, they have a much more developed system of this. You know, in the arts, we tend not to have some of those intermediaries in place.
Right. Although then they face the same kinds of risks, as you point out.
And university tech transfer offices don't know that there's arts programs at the universities, for instance. And that's part of the, what we're, one of the things we're doing is we're shopping this research to those tech transfer offices to, who are constantly looking for new ways to pump up university profiles. And like, here's some potentially untapped resources you have on campus, that aren't even thinking about it. It's not on their radar. Maybe you can work and get it there.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, please join me in thanking our panel, and we won't hold you back from lunch.